May it please the court.
You may proceed.
Your honors, in this case, with respect to the first issue, the issue is whether Mr. Randall was entitled to his requested lesser on assault in the third degree. I believe the state has conceded that there was a basis to acquit of the immediately higher offense, which was assault in the second degree. Therefore, the question before this court is, was there a basis to find him guilty? Was there a basis for a finding of guilt on the assault third? And I believe there was. There's two things I'd ask the court to note. First, the mental states are not mutually exclusive. They can overlap. And in addition, as noted in State versus Beeler, recklessness is not inconsistent with an intentional act. As such, a jury could simply find that Mr. Randall acted recklessly, that is, by shattering a bottle on the victim's head, he consciously disregarded a substantial and unjustifiable risk that he would cause physical injury, and his actions in this regard constituted a gross deviation from the standard of care a reasonable person would have exercised under similar circumstances. It's that simple. It meets the definition of recklessness, therefore providing a basis for a finding of guilt based on that instruction. Simply, the state argues, well, it's also knowing. That doesn't matter. It can be both. Conduct can be both knowing. Conduct can be reckless at the same time. I would submit to the court that all criminal acts that are knowingly committed are also meet the definition of recklessly, because in order to engage in that conduct, you have to deviate from the standard of care a reasonable person would exercise. A reasonable person would not engage in that sort of behavior. In addition, there's a basis under 562.021, which says that evidence that someone acted knowingly when recklessness suffices, then evidence that the person acted knowingly will suffice to meet that standard as well. That's under 562.021. That's another basis for finding him guilty in this case of assault third.
Do the statutes also make this a nested offense?
Your Honor, I believe that is the case, yes. And the Western District has found that that is true. Basically, it's citing to a comment from when these codes were enacted, saying that the purpose is to grade them, and they are, the Western District has found that they are nested. I would submit that they are nested as well. Your Honor, I believe there's also another basis, which is that there's imperfect self-defense. In this case, Mr. Randall got an instruction on self-defense. Now, he testified that the victim lunged at him and fired off a shot, that it didn't make contact, that then he was defending himself, and at some point he grabbed a glass bottle and hit the victim over the head with it. Now, there was also, he provided testimony that the victim was continuing to fire off shots, but the gun wouldn't go off. So that suggests that maybe at some point he should have realized that, hey, I don't need to engage in this conduct, but maybe that would be reckless. That would meet that imperfect standard of self-defense.
And these are appropriate things for you to argue, but to the extent you're arguing them, I believe one other issue that you and the state disagree on is whether there has to be evidence or an inference to support the lesser included offense. That the question is, Jackson clearly said and Pierce clearly said that you have to submit the lesser included offense even if there's not specific evidence negating an element of the greater offense. But the state argues here that you still need to present evidence supporting the lesser offense. And I believe you argue that Jackson does not say that. It says basically it's up to the jury to decide what to believe, and you don't need specific evidence of either. Is that correct?
Judge, that's absolutely correct. Also, Williams holds the same thing. In Williams, the court also said here, the state argued the same thing, that there needed to be affirmative evidence to support the lesser, and the court rejected it. Even in Williams, the court also rejected it in Jackson.
And Williams is the burglary trespassing case?
Williams was a robbery case, Your Honor,
okay.
Where I believe Williams' co-defendant testified that marijuana and other things were stolen, and Mr. Williams did not testify, I believe, was the case. Or, I'm sorry, he testified that he saw his co-defendant stealing, possibly stealing the objects, but no force was used. And the stealing was ultimately submitted. I believe it started out as a robbery first.
Thank you.
In addition, Your Honor, I believe the jury was free, Your Honors, I believe the jury was free to infer that the bottle that was not used in a manner that was capable of causing serious physical injury. I believe this differs from cases where they say it's sufficient. So here, the jury's free to find that it's not. And there would be support for that because the injury sustained by the alleged victim was not serious at all. There was a cut on his head, and I believe that's documented in Exhibits 14 and 15 that were submitted for the court's consideration. So for all those reasons, I believe there's basis to quit to find Mr. Randall guilty of the assault third. It should have been submitted by the court. But primarily, the strongest argument, again, is going back to 562.021 and Jackson. So the state wants to argue that there's a reasonable person standard. This court completely rejected that standard, or the majority at least, rejected that standard in Jackson. We'd ask the court to maintain that in this case. But for any of those who would not want to do that, that's why we've submitted the alternative basis for finding Mr. Randall guilty of the assault third. And for those reasons, I would ask the court to find that the court did err. Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you, counsel. You have some time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Proceed.
Yeah, the state has conceded that there was a basis under Jackson in this case to acquit of the greater offense. It's really not a question in this case. And the question is that what arises from the rule announced in Jackson when the jury's disbelief of evidence becomes the basis to acquit of the greater offense? A secondary question is, when the court stated in Jackson that no inference, no element, no fact is proved until a jury finds it beyond a reasonable doubt, until 12 jurors find it beyond a reasonable doubt, did the court also state that jurors can draw any inference that they want from the evidence, even if it's an unreasonable inference or an inference not supported by the evidence?
So in this case, if the jury wanted to, the jury could find he suffered no physical injuries at all.
They could find that. They could find that he suffered no physical injuries at all, in which case there would be no basis to convict of the lesser either, because it also relied on there being physical injury.
Wasn't the key to Jackson is that it was a nested lesser?
That was an important.
So necessarily, if there was proof sufficient of the greater offense, there's proof sufficient of the lower offense. So we're really talking about cases that just have a subset of elements and the basic principle that the jury is free to believe all part or none of the evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Did this case involve nested lessors?
It did not.
And explain that.
This case does not involve a nested offense because, as the court explained in Jackson, a nested offense is an offense that consists of a subset of the elements of the greater offense. In that case, the example was a robbery where the difference between first and second degree robbery was the presence of a gun, and all of the remaining elements remained the same. So the differential element, as this court termed it in Jackson, was the presence or use of a gun or what appeared to be a gun. If the jury disbelieved that evidence, if the theoretical basis for acquitting the greater offense was the jury's disbelief that there was a gun, there still remained a subset of elements that constituted the included offense. That's not true in this case. In this case, the included offense of assault in third degree has a different element that's not present in the greater offense. The greater offense required that he knowingly cause physical injury to.
Well, why isn't that within acting knowingly?
Well, I think as a matter of law under 562.021, we can certainly impose criminal liability on somebody who acts knowingly but is then guilty of a reckless offense. But the two mental states are in fact different and require a different factual finding.
But as you say, we're decided under the statute. It says if you prove one, you prove the other. If a statute requires one, you have evidence of the other, that's sufficient. I understand why you're saying in day-to-day parlance we may use the terms differently, but that's not. But the issue is, does the statute make it nested? And a separate issue, does the statute say you prove recklessly by proving knowingly?
I don't think the statute says that you prove recklessly by proving knowingly. The statute says that when recklessly suffices to establish an offense, it's also established if someone acts knowingly or purposely.
So if the person had been convicted here, if you had submitted third degree and the defendant had been convicted of that, would he have an argument that there was no evidence to support that verdict?
No, and the reason being is, and I think that this has to do with the interplay between Section 562.021 and 556.046, the one talking about general principles of liability and the other talking about instances where the trial court either can or may instruct down, or instances where the trial court might be obligated to instruct down. Now, let me explain that. There's a lot, I think, packed into that statement.
Well, in the course of doing that, explain why there would be evidence to support a judgment, but no evidence to submit the instruction.
Right. Under the statute, 556.046, a trial court can instruct on an included offense essentially in any case, whether there's a request by either party or just on its own motion. The statute is permissive in allowing the submission of included offenses at any time, so long as it is, in fact, an included offense. And it doesn't require the trial court, in any given case, it doesn't require the trial court to ask the evidentiary question of, is there a basis to acquit or a basis to convict? The only time that analysis comes into play is when a trial court is considering refusing giving an instruction that's been requested. Now, if the trial court doesn't go through that analysis and just submits an instruction on included offense, or if the trial court simply agrees this case needs to have an included offense, well, the obligations that arise under subsections 2 and subsections 3 to analyze whether the trial court is obligated to do so really don't come into play there. Anytime an instruction is submitted, there really can't be error in the submission, because the statute plainly allows and permits, it's permissive. As this court stated in State versus Beeler, 556.046 is entirely permissive in terms of submitting an instruction. So if an instruction is actually submitted to the jury, well, then the only question that remains if the defendant is convicted of that instruction is whether there's a basis to convict or to uphold that conviction. And that might be an evidentiary basis based on an inference of actual reckless conduct, or it might be as a matter of law that because the defendant had a higher culpable mental state as prescribed under 562.021, we can hold him criminally liable for something that he did, even though it had a lesser culpable mental state.
Is third degree assault specifically denominated by statute as a lesser degree of second degree assault?
The courts have interpreted it as being specifically denominated as a lesser degree.
So doesn't the statute say that therefore it's nested, therefore it's included within it?
I don't think it says it's nested.
And a defendant may be convicted of an offense included in an offense charged in the indictment or information. An offense is so included when it is specifically denominated by statute as a lesser degree of the offense charged. So if you charge him with second, he could be convicted of third.
Yes, but that doesn't mean that they're nested, as that term is contemplated. Jackson, let me give you an example.
Nested is an elements test.
It is an elements.
They could say anything was denominated a lesser, and it would be, but nested is an elements test.
That's correct.
So the question is, the requested instruction in this case that was refused, how many degrees below the charge defense was it?
Two.
Okay. What does the statute require?
The statute requires that, to submit it doesn't require
anything.
It just requires it to be included.
If requested. How many degrees down do you have to go?
Well, that's an interesting question, Your Honor.
What did the court say in State versus Johnson?
There was a period of time where subsection 3 did not exist that talked about the immediately higher offense. That came up in Hibbler as an issue in the case. And I believe the court in Hibbler held that if there's a basis to acquit of the actual charged offense, you look at that one. After Hibbler was decided, statute was amended to add in that the trial court's only obligated, well, the obligation language appears in both subsections. So I think there are two things that need to be that would need to be fulfilled in this case. First, there needs to be a basis to acquit of the charged offense under subsection 2. There also needs to be a basis to acquit of the immediately higher offense submitted to the jury under subsection 3. But under Jackson, there always will be, because the jury can disbelieve the evidence.
If they're nested lessors. Not necessarily as to denominated lessors.
Well, let me clarify that. I think even if they're not nested, there will always be a basis to acquit of the greater, because the jury could just disbelieve any evidence of the greater offense. So, but then the
question. But if they're not nested.
Right. If they're not nested.
There's an element.
That must be satisfied.
Correct.
Where do we define the term nested? Is there a statutory definition?
There's not a statutory definition, Your Honor.
So on what do you base that they're not nested?
I base it on the analysis in Jackson, which is where the term nested came into play. And it talks about it being a smaller subset of the same elements. Here, we have a different element.
And is there any case that's addressed this? You're saying where you're dealing with state of mind mens rea, then they're not nested because by definition they're different. What about a capital murder and first degree murder?
And that was an example I was going to bring up.
Okay.
Is that we have I think the nested analysis follows subdivision 1 in 556.046. There are different ways that something can be an included offense. First is proved by all or for less than the same facts. And I think that's dealing with nested offenses. Another way that it can be included offense is if it's specifically denominated by statute as a lesser degree offense. Another way is that it's an attempt. And when you look at homicides, for instance, many of them are not nested offenses. Instead, they're specifically denominated by statute as lesser degree offenses. For instance, voluntary manslaughter adds in an element that's not present in murder in the first degree and murder in the second degree, namely the element of sudden passion arising from adequate cause. That's an element that differentiates the included offense from the greater or charged offense.
Another example would be second degree felony murder.
Sure.
Because it's not nested.
That's right.
In Jackson, this court said, when dealing with nested lesser included offenses, it's impossible to commit the greater without necessarily committing the lesser. I mean, isn't that a good definition of nested?
That's a pretty good definition of nested. And then I think that the analysis then needs to turn and focus on the third step, which is whether there's a basis to convict. And I think that that's really what this.
And you would bring back the requirement of affirmative evidence.
Well, I would say that there needs to be a basis.
Well, and normally I said that in dissent in Jackson, but I was in dissent. We said there does not have to be any evidence to support the jury finding the lesser offense.
Well, let me clarify one thing. I think that in the past, and in the cases where the state has argued that there had to be affirmative evidence, the state was always arguing that there had to be affirmative evidence to acquit of the greater offense. And the court repeatedly rejected that. And ultimately in Jackson, finally overruled the language in Olson and said, not only does there not be affirmative evidence, the basis can be the jury's ability to disregard. However, when it comes to determining whether there is a basis to convict, I think it would be a strange thing if we could say there doesn't have to be any evidence of the lesser.
What about the fact that we
allow circumstantial evidence
sure.
to infer mental states every day of the week?
Yep. I have no trouble with
that. Why couldn't the jury in this case look at the circumstantial evidence alone and determine it was reckless?
Yeah, and that's when you get down to the bottom of my argument, that's the final analysis. We have a line of cases in Missouri that talk about some conduct transcending recklessness. In other words, it doesn't really support an inference of recklessness. And, those cases, as I acknowledge in my brief, those cases, I think, at least after Jackson, conceptualized it wrongly because they said, the jury would have to infer that it was knowing. But this court expressly rejected that and said, no, they don't. They can reject anything they want. But I think the question that follows then is, if we find a basis to convict, or excuse me, to acquit of the greater by saying, as a theoretical matter, the jury disbelieved the knowing evidence. But then we turn right back around and say, yeah, but they still could have believed that he knowingly did it, so we'll submit recklessly.
What's wrong with the thought in this case that the evidence is just supports a reckless without the benefit of
right.
I mean, why would we have to go through your mental gymnastics?
I don't think
to
you have
determine
to.
That, I think, that reckless is supported in this
I think,
case.
I think in some cases you don't have to go through that analysis because, as Mr. Chigurupati said today, sometimes both inferences could be drawn from the evidence. In some cases, you might have conduct that would support either inference, and I don't think we should be trying to guess which inference jurors are going to draw. But in some cases, we don't. And let me give you an example. You know, if I tied up a victim and I had them prone on the ground, face down, and I stood there for 5 minutes and I thought about the pros and cons of whether I should terminate this person's life and kill them, and then I pull out my gun and I put it and I touch the gun to the back of their head and I pull the trigger, you know, and I move the gun around their head and I pull that trigger five times. Well, I think under the law, you can hold me criminally responsible for recklessly killing that person because 562.021 says if you do it knowingly or purposely, that will establish recklessly as a general principle of liability. But I don't think there's an inference in the world that that was reckless. It was knowing. Because anybody who does that, and if you don't want to draw the knowing inference, that's fine. But I don't think it supports an inference that it was reckless, that the person merely disregarded a substantial and unjustifiable risk that they were going to cause the death of that person. And that's what it boils down to here, I think, under Jackson, is when you say that the jury can disbelieve any evidence it wants, that's fine, as a basis to acquit.
How does that distinguish Pierce, then, in which the defense counsel admitted the element of the greater offense and tried to say, but you should only consider the cocaine part and not the base in which it was dissolved, and by statute, that's not a defense. You consider the whole thing, yet we said, it's up to the jury.
I think it is up to the jury. If the defense wants to admit a fact, they can try. But I think this court rejected that and said, if the jury doesn't want to believe it, they don't have to. Now, you know, for example, a state's witness at this point, I suppose, could take the stand and say, nah, he didn't hit me at all. But then the state could introduce a prior inconsistent statement and said, yes, he did. And the jury can disregard the recantation on the stand. I mean, I think that...
So here, there was evidence he threw the bottle. Why couldn't the jury believe? He wasn't really aiming at him. He was really aiming at the wall. He threw the bottle. They could disbelieve, and that would support recklessness.
Potentially could. Now,
so doesn't that make it submissible here?
No, not under the facts of this case, or at least not as the submission was made by the defense below.
Begs the question. As the submission was made in Pierce, they couldn't either, but the jury could disbelieve that.
Well, but let me point out, The defense here asked for a lesser included offense not because the defendant testified I threw the bottle.
But it's not why you asked for it.
I think we need to look at the theory that the defense propounds in their instruction.
Tell me why.
Because the error here is the trial court refused instruction A. Instruction A says that the defendant recklessly caused physical injury to Mr. Bass by shattering a bottle on his head. Now, is it possible to hypothesize other facts that occurred in this case? The defendant certainly didn't testify, I was just trying to throw the bottle near him or anything like that. In fact, he didn't testify that he threw the bottle and hit him.
So you would require affirmative evidence of the inference that's necessary.
Of the included offense.
And is there anything in Jackson that supports that, or Pierce or any of our more recent cases, since we've overruled Pond and the
other
cases?
You know, to the extent that Jackson says you don't have to have affirmative evidence to acquit, I entirely understand that, but I would not understand the extension that if there's not any evidence to support the included offense, you still give it anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, one of the major problems with the state's theory is that at no point in time does the state say that Mr. Randall's conduct for assault third would not meet the definition of reckless. They say that it's not merely reckless, that it's also knowing. Well, that doesn't help them. Under the comments of the code, the court, as the state acknowledges in its brief, it says 562.021.4 is useful in grading offenses, making it possible to convict for lesser included offenses, and also avoids the argument that something was not done recklessly because it was done knowingly or purposely. Yet here is the state arguing that something was done knowingly and not recklessly. That's exactly what the code says you're not supposed to do. That's why that statute was enacted. That's why it shows that it was nested. And that, let's suppose we were here and the state had charged Mr. Randall with acting recklessly. If he had gotten up there and showed proof that he acted knowingly somehow, would the state then be able to turn around and say, well, wait a minute. No. They would say there's a basis for conviction under 562.021. And for that reason, they cannot turn around now and say, because we didn't ask for it, no, because it doesn't suit us.
Well, even if you look at the definition of recklessly, which is to consciously disregard a substantial and unjustifiable risk that circumstances exist or a result will follow, and such disregard constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would exercise in the situation. If you argued previously, that is encompassed in knowingly always.
Yes, and I believe that's why you don't have to go beyond just looking, is there a basis to convict? Is there a basis to find that he acted recklessly? Yes, and I believe the reason for that is it's indicative of the fact that it's nested. If you just look at the definition, again, I don't think you can knowingly commit a crime without also recklessly deviating from the standard of care.
All you're basically arguing is that the differential element in this one step down is the mental state.
Yes. No, Judge, there's also another differential.
Well, I know you have an alternative basis that you believe also exists under the evidence, but if we were just looking at this as a straight Jackson case,
yes,
you're just saying that the differential element, the only differential element under the facts, is the mental state.
Yes, Judge. And in Sanders, there's a case coming up, I believe, from the Western District that you remanded for reconsideration under Jackson, and the state cites Lowe and said that they're very similar cases. Started out as murder to involuntary. In Lowe, they said prior to Jackson, the Western District, we can't submit the lesser, and because no rational juror could find. Then now in Sanders, the Western District has reversed itself, citing to Jackson, saying, well, that no longer exists. People are free to draw those inferences, and it's up to the jury to decide.
Can you address the argument or the issue raised by Judge Fisher in quoting Jackson, saying a nested offense is one where you automatically prove the lesser by proving the greater, and that wouldn't be true, for instance, in felony murder, and is it true here?
Judge, I think it is true here because under 562.021, they say that that's exactly the case. If you prove, if there's evidence that the defendant acted knowingly and he was charged with recklessly, you've proven it, there's a basis to convict it. That's what that whole statute says.
But I understand it says that.
Okay.
But do you even really need that? Why do you need that? Because the circumstantial evidence itself could be taken either way.
Judge, I agree with that. I think it's an alternative basis. If for some reason someone would find that this was not recklessly, then we could turn to that statute. But yes, I agree with you, Judge, that it's not necessary. Also, there's the imperfect self-defense claim, which the state has not addressed at all. That provides another basis as well. And in Jackson, the whole holding, the trial court actually said, it says here that, to quote the opinion, a lesser included offense instruction was not required, the trial court held, because there was no basis in the evidence for a reasonable juror to determine that the victim did not reasonably believe that Jackson was holding a gun to her back throughout the robbery. This was error. And then the court spent a great majority of the opinion explaining why the reasonable juror standard was being, that it was being abandoned. And so therefore, here is the state now saying the exact same thing, citing to Lowe, which was abrogated by Jackson, for that very proposition that no reasonable juror could find that he did not act knowingly. The state does not even suggest that he did not act merely recklessly. The state does not suggest that he did not act recklessly. They said he did not act merely recklessly.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your time has expired. The case will be taken under submission.